Doncic pulls up, three-pointer. Bang! Bang! It's good! Doncic wins the game at the buzzer!
What's up, guys? Welcome to Birdwatch. I'm Christian Clark, the Pelicans beat writer for NOLA.com and The Advocate. Here today, 24 hours after Luka Doncic's 27-foot step-back jumper, I'm still a little bit high from the fumes. Jeff, how are you feeling? Have you completely come down from that yet?
I don't know. Has he stopped making shots yet? Because I feel like he just walked off the court and just kept draining threes. That game kind of made me think back to a Pelicans game that I was at a few years ago when he was going back up and down the court, just trading shots with Anthony Davis. I think the Pelicans actually won that game, but I remember thinking, like, he's 19 years old. That's insane. And now he's 21 years old, and it's no less insane.
I haven't sat down and dug through the list of and like done official rankings of people who killed the Pelicans the most this season. But just my first guess or inclination is to go with Luka. I mean, he destroyed the Pelicans this year in every game he played against them. I mean, of course, the one that really comes to mind is when they were in Dallas and lost by 46 points. It was a franchise record for the most lopsided regular season loss.
Yeah, that was that weird, like, 2 p.m. start.
Yeah, yeah. Right? It was like a 1 p.m., you know, matinee game or whatever. And, you know, what I remember about what Luka did to the Pelicans this year was it was all in three quarters. Like, they just whooped him so bad that, you know, he had, like, his 30, 10, and 10 or whatever. And then he just sat the entire fourth quarter and, like, goofed off with Boban.
Yeah, the only game that comes to mind of a guy just completely manhandling them is the game that they went to Boston and got just completely run off the court, and Jason Tatum had something like 38 and three quarters. But Luka did it in every matchup, and they played four times. But yeah, that game, when I watched the Clippers game, that's when I kept thinking back to that game, like when in the bubble when the Clippers just steamrolled the Pelicans. That's the only game of the season that I could really compare it to. And like, have they been beaten this badly in any other game? And those are the two, the Celtics in Boston and the weird afternoon mix up, which is what I'm calling it because it wasn't a game, against Dallas.
I hope Vlade Divac was not watching that game on Sunday, because there, you know, with every game that goes by, there's less and less of a case that he should ever have a job in a front office again. I mean, Luka's 21 years old, and it already looks like an all-time blunder of going Bagley over Luka. It is brutal, man. I mean, Vlade is, you know, from that part of the world. You know, he had a relationship with like Luka's dad, and you still couldn't get it right. It's unbelievable. And the Suns too. The Suns head coach, and that, you know, they hired Igor Kokoschkov, who had just won FIBA with Luka, you know, as a star player. It's unbelievable that, you know, two of the franchises in the past that I've had these pretty close ties to Luka, and yet, nope, didn't see it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't hate too much on the Suns getting DeAndre Ayton number one. Like, it's not like DeAndre Ayton has been bad. He just hasn't been, you know, this generational player. But the Suns were incredible in the bubble, and he was a big part of that. It's not like a Greg Oden, Kevin Durant scenario where the guy you took number one is objectively the wrong choice. Because I think DeAndre Ayton's a very good player. We just haven't gotten a chance to see him on a national stage. Did the Suns even get a nationally televised game in the bubble? I don't think they did.
I think they might have had like two or three, but I would have to check on that. There have just been some absurd overall offensive performances. I saw Matt Moore tweeting today just, you know, how much offense is up, you know, so far in the playoffs compared to previous years. I guess it makes sense. I mean, it was fairly predictable. It just, you know, seems like it's a lot easier to just, you know, shoot a basketball off a straight catch and shoot when there aren't, you know, 20,000 fans going nuts. But the shot making has been pretty incredible to see. Like Donovan Mitchell, I mean, he's like averaging more than a point a minute against the Nuggets. There've been some incredible offensive performances so far in the bubble. And, you know, even if it dies down a little bit, I still expect, you know, to see offense up year over year. I think mainly because of the lack of fans, but it's been really fun to watch. And, you know, probably no one has been more fun than Luka now. He's passed Dame Lillard in the poll by a couple of strides now.
Yeah, I mean, did anyone think that shot wasn't going in when he took it? And it's too bad because Marcus Morris had, well, is it Marcus or Markeith on that? I think it's Marcus.
Yeah, Marcus Morris.
Yeah, he hit an incredible shot right before that and had like an all-time great celebration because I can't remember who it was on the Mavs, but he like shot his shoe. If you saw that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, that's one of the most clutch shots I've seen until the most clutch shot I've seen right after that. But I don't even remember what we're talking about. Oh, the shot making. Yeah, I think we talked on this podcast early on that, you know, I think the shooting is very, or the atmosphere is very amenable to like crazy effective and efficient shooting performances. And I think that's what you've seen. There are a lot of games that you can go back and look at and just see one team just run another team off the court because they wouldn't miss. And the other team, even if they shot respectable, just didn't have a chance. If, you know, Dame Lillard is dropping 61, you're going to have a hard time. And it's weird because I keep watching it. I have the game on next to me and I keep forgetting that there aren't fans there. But I don't think the players on the court ever forget.
Yeah. Yeah. Jamal Murray and Donovan Mitchell dueling 50-point games. That was pretty cool to see. That was the first time it's ever happened in a playoff game. So on this week's show, we're going to play a little bit of Angel on the Shoulder and Devil on the Shoulder. We are going to be optimists and pessimists. This episode, we're going to go over, you know, I think five of the main reasons to be optimistic about the direction the Pelicans are headed in. And I think they're are a number of legit ones. I mean, I didn't have to work that hard to come up with this list. Before we get into that, just a quick note on the Pelicans coaching search. Brett Brown in Philadelphia got fired today. Now, you know, it's looking like there are at least going to be three pretty good jobs open, you know, Philadelphia, Brooklyn, and New Orleans. And, you know, that's not to even mention, you know, some of the other jobs that are available or might become available, Chicago, for instance. But I bring this up to say it looks like Ty Lue is going to have options. I mean, he's rumored, you know, to have interest in Brooklyn. A couple people reported today that there's mutual interest between Ty and Philadelphia. And then, you know, I think Woj had, you know, as soon as Alvin got fired, that New Orleans had some interest in Ty. So I think what we see, you know, one is potentially a bidding war, and two, what does Ty Lue want? I mean, the very early reporting suggests that maybe, you know, Philadelphia is more intriguing to him than the other two places. But I think it's going to be really fascinating into just like, what does Ty want at this stage of his life? Because each job is a little bit different. Each job is promising in its own way. What do you think about the three situations and Ty potentially getting to pick between them?
Well, first, I haven't kept track of it. Have the Nets made a decision on what they are going to do with Jock Vaughn?
No, they've basically telegraphed this interest in Greg Popovich, which seems kind of like a pipe dream. They've said, you know, the reporting that's come out has said Jock Vaughn is going to be seriously considered. Ties got thrown in there, so no.
Right. I mean, I'd be stunned if they just said, "Here, Jock, take over this Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, Maserati, whatever car you want to use. It could be a Lamborghini if that fits your eye better."
I feel like it should be more techier, like a Tesla or something, like a pimped out Tesla. But continue.
It goes really well over flat surfaces, whatever it is. But you know, it's still in there, you know, and that could change a lot if they end up just standing pat there because it takes away one of those landing spots. And I tweeted this today after seeing the, you know, the Brett Brown news, which was, Pelicans fans throughout this search, you should be, you know, you need to be aware of the fact that the Pelicans, when they come up with their list of, okay, we want this person as our head coach, they might not have the ability to get their top choice. They might not have the ability to get their second choice if, you know, if they want Ty Lue and Ty Lue says, no, I want to be in Philly. And then they want, pick a name out of a hat. If the guys they want end up going other places they find more attractive, you might be on your third option of who you wanted to be the head coach of your team. And it's easy to make an argument that even beyond all the players, Philadelphia and Brooklyn are just better, more attractive places to go to be a head coach. It's a big, they're bigger markets. They're more ravenous fan bases. And you have star players that are ready to win now versus New Orleans, who has this great upward trajectory, but it's going to be a lot more painful work to get to the point where you feel like you can win a title. So there's no reason to think that, you know, Ty Lue, if he's hedging on Philly, will be like, no, I'd rather work my ass off for the next 2 years and wait for, you know, Zion to grow into a player that is what Joel Embiid is now in terms of that type of dominant, like consistent player. But it's interesting. And a guy like Brett Brown, I find very intriguing for the Pelicans. I tweeted that out just in terms of like, he makes a whole lot of sense. If you're just looking at the broad strokes of his career, he's done exactly what the Pelicans are trying to do now, which is turn a losing culture into a consistent winning culture, and doing it while balancing the health of your star player and bringing along a bunch of other high draft picks that you need to reach the level that you're competing. And when I say an injured star player, I mean Joel Embiid, who really didn't even play his first two seasons. People freaked out because Zion didn't play in the second night of a back-to-back. Joel Embiid didn't play the second night of a back-to-back. I don't even know if he is now. I mean, he'll still get random nights off. So I find that a really intriguing option if they go that route.
So I think one of the reasons that Ty Lue isn't such high demand, or seems to be, is that, you know, one of the pros of him taking over is that he can hold star players accountable. There's, you know, the famous story of him, you know, going to LeBron at halftime of Game 7 of the 2016 Finals saying, hey, man, you need to be better. And LeBron took him seriously. I think that's a difficult thing to do. I mean, the NBA stars have never had more power than they do right now. And I guess that's one reason why I would be a little worried about Brett Brown, you know, coming into New Orleans. I mean, there's, I guess, some of the reporting coming out is basically saying that he had a hard time, you know, motivating Joel Embiid. And it just, you know, by the end of it, it just seemed like he had trouble managing and getting the best out of a lot of different personalities, which is not to pin all of the blame on him, because there are a lot of different things wrong with that situation. But I mean, I think one of the big things that the Pelicans are looking for is going to be someone who can motivate Zion Williamson. And, you know, I can't say for sure if Brett Brown is that guy. I mean, just my read on the situation from afar is probably not, but that's kind of where I'm at with him right now.
Oh, I agree with you. And I actually am very critical of the job that Brett Brown has done in Philadelphia. I have never thought that he got the most he could get out of that team. But you can't argue that he didn't create a consistent winning product. So I don't know. And it kind of goes back to what I said earlier. You know, it's not necessarily that Brett Brown is the top choice that they should be looking at. But what happens if you land on your third option? Is Brett Brown the third best option of the coaches that you identify? I don't know. I just think that he's an interesting name, and it'll be interesting to see if the Pelicans choose to go down that road. J.J. Redick obviously will have a lot to say on the subject one way or the other. So if David Griffin is interested, he definitely has someone who can call and to get the inside scoop on that situation.
Yeah, J.J. and Brett Brown have a bromance. I saw it when I was in Philly this year. Big fans of each other. Yeah, Brett Brown, whatever you want to say about him, all-around good guy. Okay, let's get into this list. Today, we're going to be angels on the shoulder. We're going to start the week off pumping you with positivity. We are just going to pump sunshine directly in your direction. And, you know, I think the number one thing that you have to say about reasons to be optimistic about this team and this franchise, where it's headed, Zion Williamson is a star. I mean, you know, star, I guess that can have multiple definitions. The way, you know, I'm kind of trying to define it is, next season, if X player is healthy and is in shape, are they a top 20 player in the league? Do you feel pretty good about that? And I do feel good about that. I feel like if Zion, you know, gets that knee right and shows back in shape, there's no reason why he can't be a top 20 player as early as next season. I mean, in 24 games this year, he was coming off a major knee injury. He was not in shape for most of the games he played. 22.5 points, shot 58% from the field. He got to the line 7.5 times per game. I was looking at some comps of dominant centers in the rookie season. I mean, I know that's not perfect. Zion isn't a true center. He's really a power forward who you'd like to think can spend some time you know, at small ball center. But he is a guy who puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the rim. So I tried to look at some comps. Shaquille O'Neal is a 20-year-old rookie. 23 points per game, 56% shooting. Hakeem Olajuwon is a 22-year-old rookie. 21 points per game, 54% shooting. David Robinson is a 24-year-old rookie in those 2 years of military service. 24 points per game, 53% shooting from the field. You know, Zion is right there, if not even more efficient as those guys, Shaq, Hakeem, and Robinson, just legit legends. And this is all while he's coming off a major knee injury. I mean, look, we can all see it. The talent is just through the roof. I've said this a couple of times, you know, when we've talked over the past few weeks. It's kind of just up to him. I mean, there are so many areas where they're realistic, that are realistic avenues for growth. I mean, the sky really is the limit for this guy. And I think, you know, this coaching hire will, you know, be a big factor in how can you get the most out of him. But at the end of the day, it's just up to him.
Right. And one of the things that, you know, I spent most of my time throughout the whole seeding game process, like, trying to talk people off the ledge on Twitter that he's just fat and out of shape and that he needs to get all this undue criticism. But at the end of the day, you know, I have to admit, I was incredibly disappointed in terms of what he showed in that return. And I know there's so many things working against him in terms of having to leave the bubble. And, you know, he was finally getting into shape and then there was the hiatus. But there was just so much that looked like it was ready to go well. And then it didn't. And it was it took the air out of the balloon really fast. And I think that, you know, what he can do next season in terms of allaying a lot of that is just making sure he shows up in the best shape possible. You know, he needs to take care of his body and he needs to start right now. He doesn't have the luxury of waiting around and saying, okay, I'm going to ramp up the same way everyone else does, because I don't think that his ramp up is the same as everybody else's. And I think that he is a star, and it's interesting that he's compared, you know, you put him on this list next to a bunch of centers and say, look at this efficiency next to centers. If he spends his entire career as a center level efficiency type player, I think that'll be a disappointment, because you want him to expand. And I think, you know, I'm being a little negative here, and we're supposed to be, you know, positive people on this episode, but I think that it is a positive thing, because everything that went wrong in terms of his fitness, in terms of his time on the floor, in terms of the development of his game beyond being this hyper-efficient center type player, did. And, you know, maybe you got all that out of the way and next year you kind of come into it with a clean slate, and it's a complete, I say next year, like 3 months from now, you come into it with a clean slate and he looks like a different type of athlete in terms of what we expected out of Duke.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much he can add. I mean, I really do believe in his potential on the defensive end. We saw it at Duke. He just had a different body type in college. But, like, the passing is another thing I think that really pops with him. I mean, I just keep going back to the play in the bubble where he caught it on the break and then whipped it behind the back to Lonzo. Serious Escalade flashbacks. I mean, I just think, you know, on the low range of outcomes for Zion, like, he's probably at minimum a guy, you know, you can just dump it to in the post and he's like a guaranteed bucket or get to the free throw line. And he's a solid enough passer to just find the open man spotting up along the perimeter. And like I said, I think that's on the low range of outcomes. I mean, there's just so much this guy can do. We didn't really see him, you know, catching the ball off movement and attacking people off movement as much as we did even in the preseason. It was a lot of just dump it into him down low, and he's either going to go left and try to bull rush you or just take that one jab step and then go right. And he was pretty good at it. I mean, the bag of tricks was not that deep, and there wasn't a whole lot people could do with him.
I also don't think Gentry's offensive system necessarily, it seemed in theory, it seemed like it would benefit him at peak form. But I think the player that Zion was for most of the season, you could argue all of the season, didn't benefit from that. Like he would ditch on the defensive glass and try to get out in transition when he came back, he got a lot of those like run out dunks in the half court lobs. But when you take a lot of that away, it didn't suit him in the half court the way that you could have taken advantage of that. And, you know, maybe with a different coach and a different system, it looks a lot different.
Okay, moving on to number two on this list. Brandon Ingram might be a star. I'm kind of operating on the same definition here. You know, on his next contract, is there a realistic pathway for him becoming a top 20 player? I mean, I think, yeah. I think the deal he's going to agree to with the Pelicans, you know, he's going to be a restricted free agent. I expect them to step up to the plate and get that done pretty quickly. You know, maybe you're looking at 4 or 5 years. So I think there's a decent chance that Brandon Ingram becomes a top 20 guy, you know, somewhere in that span. And we've just seen in this league, it more often than not is going to take multiple stars to win a championship. I mean, to already have two guys on the roster, you know, one of them you feel like, oh, I like his chances a lot of becoming a top 15, 20 guy. And the other guy, you know, I think you feel pretty good about in Ingram, I think is just a huge plus. I mean, this year, career highs pretty much across the board, points, rebounds, assists. 3-point percentage was way up. I just wrote a big thing about that. Free throw percentage was way up. I don't think he was quite as good as the raw numbers suggest. I think he's got a long ways to go on the defensive end, and I think the Pelicans have been very upfront that that's what he needs to improve next. I mean, I think they've been pretty direct with him. One of the things they like is that they can keep it real with Brandon Ingram. I mean, they tell him all this stuff to his face, and you know, he knows it, and he's communicated with the media. But, you know, I like Brandon Ingram, the player. I get why, you know, the Pelicans are almost assuredly going to bet big on him here, you know, in the upcoming offseason. Where are you just at in terms of, you know, Ingram's chances of becoming like the number two that you need to be going to conference finals and possibly even further here in the next couple of years?
Well, first I have a question for you, and I'm interested in your answer because I have my answer. So you say, can Ingram become a top 20 player? Who, in your opinion, would be the 20th best player in the NBA? Name a player, and like, that's the line. He needs to be that good or better to be in the top 20.
Oh, that's shoot, man. That's
it's really a tough question. That's why I wanted to get to.
I feel like I've got my top. I feel like I've got my top 10. Am I like now that you're getting to the 20 range? I mean, I don't think he was even as impactful as like either of Boston's two young wings, Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown. I mean, so I think, you know, there's considerable work to do.
I mean, just like a specific player.
Well, I need some names to go off of. I don't know. I was unprepared for this.
mine would be Jimmy Butler, who I'm watching currently. Like,
I think Jimmy Butler's like probably better than 20, though. I don't know.
I think it, but it's in that range. You know what I mean? Like, that's the type of player that, like, that's the type of star that Brandon Ingram needs to become. He needs to become like this guy who never stops working, who you trust in clutch situations, who you know you can just give the ball to. And, you know, Jimmy Butler's a guy who he just has no holes in his game. And that's what makes him so good, in my opinion. He's a decent shooter. He's not a great shooter. He's a very good defender, but he's not like Kawhi level. You know, he can drive, he can pass, he can do everything you need him to do. And that's what makes him a top 20 player. Whereas he didn't come into the league that way.
If you're asking me, like, do you think Brandon Ingram ever becomes as good as Jimmy Butler? Like, I don't feel great about that. I mean, I think, you know, maybe something more realistic and you're still being optimistic is like, you know, better than DeMar DeRozan, but not quite on par with Jimmy Butler, like halfway in between the two, maybe closer to Butler.
Yeah, well, yeah, they're similar players when you look at it. I mean,
but Butler carries teams, and he's a fantastic defender.
And Butler's a tough one too, because so much about what makes him great is the fact that he's crazy. and DeMar, you know, DeMar's another one of those guys where, you know, is he a star player when, you know, he's a mid-range guy that is kind of in the wrong era? I don't know. It's tough. But when you talk about Ingram, and this has kind of gone off the rails a little bit, I apologize for that. I think he has the aptitude to become a great player. It's just the matter of whether he gets there. And that's the part that I don't know. But that's always been the case with him. I think Rob Perez tweeted a few years ago, early in Ingram's career, it's like every time you see Brandon Ingram play, it's like either future NBA MVP or future China League MVP. And he's gotten a lot more consistent since then. But that was what you kind of looked at. He went number two in the draft, and all of a sudden you saw this guy who would make these incredible plays, but then you would see these massive holes that he needed to fill in his game to be consistent. And I think that this year, offensively, and especially from the three-point line, he did that, and he proved a lot in terms of what he can do. And I think that he's on a trajectory to be a top 20 caliber player. It's just a matter of whether he gets there.
So number three on this list, this ties in a little bit to, you know, the player we just discussed. The Pelicans were one of the best three-point shooting teams in the NBA. I feel like if you had told somebody that at the start of the year, they would have not believed you at all. I mean, that was really one of the big legit question marks about this team going into the season. The Pelicans finished seventh in three-point attempts and seventh in three-point percentage. J.J. Redick was a big reason for that. I mean, even in year 14, he's still got the fastball that can touch 95, shot 45% from three, still, you know, hits it falling out of bounds, coming off of screens, like guys diving into his waist, tripping him, just can still hit every kind of three, even though, you know, he is a step slower on the defensive end these days. The two big surprises were two former Lakers, Brandon Ingram and Lonzo Ball. Ingram shot 39% on upwards of six per game. Lonzo shot 37.5% also on upwards of six per game. Both those guys changed the mechanics of their shots. You know, I think they deserve the credit for that first and foremost. I mean, they put the work in and actually did it in the games. But the assistant coach they worked with and helped them make those changes was Fred Vinson. One of the low-key storylines I'm going to be monitoring this offseason, can the Pelicans keep Fred Vinson? I think that's the plan. I think they really hope that they can. But he clearly had a positive impact on a couple of players on this team. And yeah, I mean, if the Pelicans can just surround Zion Williamson with plus outside shooting, that's a pathway to success. Because we know if you just give Zion space, we'll see what they do at the five this offseason, that he's just going to dominate in there.
Yeah, and I think Lonzo specifically, I get so up and down on Lonzo from game to game, because you'll see these games where he looks like the star player that everyone expected him to be at UCLA. And then you'll have these games where he completely vanishes and reverts back to step back three pointers and floaters that he just can't make. He can't make a floater to save his life. It's bizarre. A guy with that great touch of the ball can't make a floater, but he's just not good at it. And I think there are a lot of times this season where he would have these great games, and then when he would fall into a rut, he would revert back to those bad shots. And when you look at his three-point shooting, I think that that number is actually more encouraging than it looks, because, or that is including some of the really, all the really bad shots. And I'm trying to, let's see. You have listed here, we have the catch and shoot three-pointers, which he was 38.9% on, and pull-ups, which he was 31.9% on. And that all kind of wrapped into 37.5%. But the shot he took a lot of that I hate is the step-back three-pointer. He made 6 of 34 of those this year. That is 17.6%. Now, 34 shot attempts doesn't seem like that much unless you're only hitting them 17% of the time. Then every one you take is the worst shot you could take at that moment. And he saw that happen in a lot of crucial moments. I think in the Jazz game specifically, a game he went 1 for 13, the one in the bubble, he had back-to-back possessions where he was already 1 for 11 and settled for a pull-up and a step-back three. And those are the moments that you think like, okay, these are what you need to iron out. And then all of a sudden we have a player that I think is elevating the team, where a lot of times he was not. But I think you have to be encouraged by what you saw from Lonzo this year, because you just had no idea what to expect when you brought him in.
I mean, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. He's one of the hardest players in the NBA to figure out. I mean, you can ask five people and get five different responses. He's a truly baffling player. I tend to think that the three-point shooting is fairly real because of the mechanical changes he made, but it also terrifies me that he still can't make a free throw. I mean, that just, that doesn't do a lot for my confidence that he's just going to be this plus shooter. He's still just afraid to drive the ball inside. I mean, he tosses up like weak bricks. He doesn't want to, you know, make contact. So I don't know. He's a very bad fit player, but I give him credit for fixing the three-point shot. That was huge for the Pelicans this year. Okay, so number four coming up, Gil Benson has just showed over the past 12, 18 months that she is financially committed, I think, in a way that Pelicans ownership probably has never been, you know, with this franchise. This was a little bit before I came in, but she greenlit all the changes to the practice facility. That was around a $5 million investment. That helped the Pelicans, you know, bring in a new medical staff, and kind of the jury is still out on that. I think, you know, that's something you can evaluate after a 2 or 3 year window. Just in the past 2 weeks here, Gail has agreed to basically, you know, let Alvin Gentry chill at home next year. It was reported that there's $5 million left in his deal. I believe Fletcher Macro reported that it's going to cost her between $8 and $10 million to hire a new coaching staff and assistants and all that jazz. So, I mean, I see this all the time from various people. Ownership is the biggest competitive advantage in sports. I think Gail Benson is in, and, you know, that's a new thing for this franchise, and it's just huge.
Yeah, and then when we were talking about the coaching search stuff, I mentioned that, you know, New Orleans might not be the most attractive place to go for a head coach with options. And this is a factor in terms of making that less of an issue as you're trying to bring in free agents and you're trying to hire a coach. You know, when you're a coach and you see a team that's committed to its practice facilities and making sure that the team has what it needs competitively, that's a big thing. And you couldn't say that about the Pelicans for a lot of the time leading up to Gail taking over, but I think you can now. I don't think that's not the question anymore. The question is, can you create a team that can win? And are you bringing in the right people? Whether you can bring in people.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to win an NBA championship in New Orleans. I mean, here or Memphis, you know, those are the two smallest markets in the NBA. Those might be, you know, the most difficult places. And they're doing everything they need to do right now. They're laying, I think, a solid foundation. And we'll just, you know, see what the structure looks like in a couple of years. But I think they're taking the right steps right now. Last on my list here is the draft pick situation. You know, Griff mentioned this a little bit when, you know, he was talking about the head coaching search, why this is such an attractive situation. Maybe it's a little hyperbolic to say they have a war chest of picks, but they have a lot of really interesting picks here. I mean, there are some second rounders. And then when you look at the first rounders, you know, they basically have a combination of three picks slash swaps from the Lakers that are going to hit in that trade. The first round pick they're likely to get is 2022. I'm just going to assume that next year, you know, the Lakers are not going to suck. I mean, basically, as long as the Lakers don't stink, then the Pelicans will get an unprotected first in 2022. In 2023, the Pelicans get a pick swap with the Lakers. And then in 2024, that's the big daddy. You know, you're really hopeful that LeBron James is hung it up. He's on the sidelines watching Bronny Jr. do his thing for the Atlanta Hawks or whoever it is by that point. And that's just an unprotected first that the Pelicans can kick the can down on the road to 2025 if they want to. They have an option for unprotected first in 24 or 25. And I think, too, there are going to be some options to pick even more first up here, depending on what they do with Jrue Holiday. I mean, this could either look like players they add around the Zion Williamson, Brandon Ingram core, or maybe you just save some of this stuff up for, you know, disgruntled star X.
It really does feel like, and even now more than then, when you go through all the picks that the Pelicans got, like the Lakers basically just said, you can't have Kyle Kuzma. And then basically anything else the Pelicans asked for, they got. Like they have a reverse protection on the first round pick. Now, I have never seen a pick get traded and have it be a top eight protected pick and have that benefit the team that's getting it. It's like the Cavs pick they got this year, or they got in the Hawks trade, was top 10 protected. But that means if it was in the top 10, the Cavs kept it. In this case, the Pelicans have it protected. So basically, so if it's 1 through 7, the Pelicans get it. So it's like that protection is making sure it's like, okay, if it's a good pick, we'll take it. If somehow you end up that high in the lottery, we'll take it. But otherwise, keep it. And that's funny to me. The only team that I can think of that, you know, you saw with this many picks in 3 consecutive drafts or 4 consecutive drafts is the Celtics when they pulled off the Brooklyn trade where they got, I don't even remember, they traded Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, and Jason Terry and got the Nets' soul. And even then, you know, you look at it and it's impossible for the Pelicans to benefit as well as they did because they got the number one pick out of one of those Nets picks because they bottomed out so quickly. You're not going to see that with the Lakers, I don't think. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how they take advantage of.
Yeah. Have you ever seen a team, you know, get the option of we've got an unprotected, but also we can decide what year it is. Like they can opt that to kick it down the road a year. I've never seen that.
I didn't even know that was an option. And that's when I say, like, I think the Lakers just got this list of stuff from David Griffin and they were just like, yeah, it's all fine. We just want Kyle. And that was just like on subsection B and a footnote. And they're like, oh, okay, fine. What's the worst that happens? But the thing to keep in mind, too, as you go forward, it's like, okay, yeah, the Lakers might be bad in 2023. But I think what you learn from in watching the Celtics, what you learned is when a team doesn't own their own pick, it's not going to be that good. When the Celtics had the Kings pick, they just somehow became the 13th best team in the NBA because they didn't care enough to lose to get a good pick. So I almost think that it benefits you more to use future assets as their perceived value versus hoping that their actual value is better than that. Because it almost always isn't. Once you make a pick, the value drops off a cliff. It's like when you drive a car off a lot. Because everyone wants the idea of being able to pick their star that they have decided. Once that player is on your roster, he stops feeling like that value.
Right, yeah. Like, the Grizzlies were going to try like hell this year, basically.
Yeah.
Like, they had every incentive to go balls to the wall, basically. Yeah. Well, Jeff, this was fun. I ordered 2 of those sets of plastic devil horns. One should be coming over to your place here in the next couple of days. I got one coming to mine. I'm thinking that we both wear our devil horns for the next one. I have a couple plastic pitchforks too. You know, I did it up. I'm thinking about throwing it in a tail. I haven't decided yet, but it's prime, so it should be there in time.
Some random Etsy retailer is having a great weekend because you cleared out her stash of devil's horns in what month is it? August? I guess it's almost Halloween, so you know, maybe this is Etsy season anyway.
Yeah, he's like, why is this guy ordering one for him and one for a guy who lives 2 miles away? This is really weird. All right, well, appreciate you guys for listening. Subscribe, leave a review. It really helps us out if you mash a 5-star review, and we will talk to you again soon.
Peace.